Well, welcome back. Sorry for the delay. We had a work emergency. No, just kidding. There's no emergency. You don't have to come in. Thanks for telling me that. I'm halfway in. Appreciate it. Cancel on Facebook, uncancel on Facebook. So thank you for your patience with the whiplash. All right. As we said last week, one of the things we wanted to hear first was from folks who have kind of attempted our initial steps here in figuring out how to love others. So we're still working on two things, and most of the topic today will be, after we talk about loving others, we'll switch a little bit towards loving God, because although this one is, loving others is easier to immediately apply, because you can swing your elbow and hit others in the head pretty easily and see the effects of that, the feedback loop for dealing with God seems to be different than that. It seems to be harder to feel whether you're loving God, to feel whether God's loving you. I think you have probably experienced a time in your life when you wondered, not only does God love me, maybe is he even there? So you usually don't have that problem with the other person who's either the significant other you have or someone at work or something like that. So we'll end up talking a little bit more about this today. But let's start with this. Who here is brave enough, willing enough to try to relate a little bit of how their attempts went, either positive or negative? Like good scientists, we want to report null results just as much as we do results that reinforce the hypothesis. Anybody want to give me a shot? Good.
I was trying to figure out how to love God and what I wanted to know about him when I realized the same way that you want to do it with your spouse is to know them very well, because then you can find out and realize what they love and what they want. And so I couldn't think of what I wanted to find out about God, but I realized I needed to know him more in order to love him more.
Okay, good.
So it wasn't really a result, and it was an attempt that didn't work, but it led me in a different direction.
Realization is always key. In fact, back to our kind of addict model we've been using occasionally. We've been using the addict model and the workout model, and maybe they fit together occasionally. The first step is always an understanding of what it is you're trying to do. And that first dawning moment of when you start to get what your task should look like is a great thing, because it can definitely help you with the next steps. All right, what else? Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
So I don't want this to come out the wrong way, but I'm sure it's going to.
I'll take advantage of that then.
I was trying to love one of my friends who I found it really difficult to love, because the best way I can describe her, she's a hypochondriac, and she's one of those people who's kind of always seeking attention for it. And I tried to reach out to her, and I tried to hang out with her, and she set me up for failure, because I forgot to hang out with her. And that was totally my bad. I have no good excuse. And so I go into school the next day, and I'm profusely apologizing. And I asked her, why didn't you text me? Like, why didn't you say, where are you, so I could come over and hang out with you? And she said, oh, I just wanted to see what you would do. So she specifically didn't remind me.
Right.
To see if I would fail. And then she made me feel guilty for the rest of the day, even if I was trying to make up for what I had done.
Yep.
She took that one mistake of mine and she made it into a much bigger deal than it needed to be. So that was frustrating for me, and it's made it harder for me to love her.
Gotcha. Now this is a very interesting example, and probably three good things to pull out of this one. Number one, what was the task for this week? Who were we to love? Who are we going to try? The easiest possible person you could find. So, like me, when I go to the gym, I haven't been to the gym for way too long. I go to the gym and I remember how I lifted when I was 26 years old. And I look at the bar and I look at the guys around me and they're throwing up weights that are impressive. And I'm like, do I go put the 25s on the barbell and start doing bench presses? No, I can't possibly. I can do this. And I go rack up all the big weight that I did when I was 25 and I throw it up and I show up the next day and I'm like, I can't move my arms at all. Can I just work like this? So you started with a lift too hard, all right? So that's part of the issue is if you're going to be excellent, you work on the form first. You work on the form first. So start with somebody easier. The hypochondria thing actually runs a little bit in my family. I recently was cleaning off some stuff in the garage and used a concentrated degreaser, and my hand started to tingle, and I'm like, oh, no. And so I look at the thing and it says, yes, this has a strong base in it. Make sure you use gloves. And of course, it had leached through the towel and gotten on my hands. And then I started, what's the first thing you do after this? What's the next thing you do?
Lick your fingers.
Close. Google search on sodium hydroxide burns. Do not do a Google search on sodium hydroxide burns. You won't be able to sleep for the next week. So I look for, what am I supposed to do? Everything says, this is a medical emergency. Get to the emergency place. Soak your hands in. So I had a pot full of salt water. I go into the emergency room with my hands immersed in a pot full of salt water. Like I'm boiling lobsters and my hands at the same time. And I, you know, put the pot on the check-in counter, and the lady's looking at me like, mental health division? And I'm like, no possible base burns. And so they took me in, and very reassuringly, the emergency room said, yeah, we actually don't know what to do with this. We need the MSD, the safety sheet on this one. We'll call poison control. I'm like, I could have called poison control. Mm-hmm. They're like, yes, but you can pay us $100 and then we'll call poison control for you. So we did that, and they basically were like, nope, you don't have to worry about it. This is too low a concentration. So I was diagnosed with acute hypochondria and prescribed a strong placebo. Yep. So, yes, sir.
If you called me, I could have told you what to do with being a chemist.
Oh. Actually, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a
good point.
I remember what happened in chemistry lab in college. Some guy was carrying one of these big carboys, glass carboy, and sodium concentrated sodium. He dropped it, hit the floor, splat. This stuff is
nasty. Yeah.
Burned his legs, and I was on the other side of the legs, and it didn't affect me. This other student said, I'm a chemist, I can fix this. He grabs a carboy with fuming sulfuric acid.
Acid, right? Because it'll be back to pH zero.
He neutralizes the sodium hydroxide. So he smashes this on top of the sodium hydroxide. The explosion.
Right.
Burned the shit out of him. He burns all of it. The parents of Seminus sued the it was hot. So if you had called me, I'd have told you, find some acid.
I was saying, were you the second student in that, the chemist in that story? So an interesting point was brought up was this. Two interactions were very key there. One of them, and I do this all the time, when I treat somebody, and I'm picking on you, thank you for bringing up the thing. So this may or may not be what you intended, but this is how it would have been had I been done those same actions in your situation. When I interact with somebody poorly, and I know I did a bad job interacting with them, my first inclination is I say to myself, you know, I did that wrongly. And then I'll pick up the phone and say something like this. Hey, I'm sorry. Why didn't you blank? Which is to say, let me put some of the responsibility for my failure on you. I promised to link up with you, but I failed to do so. Why didn't you call me? You bear some level of responsibility too. And had you done that, everything would have been fine. That is a natural human reaction too, and one to avoid. If you really want to love somebody, the fault always, always lies with you. You do not, the scriptures say, we do not even reckon. That's the way God does it. He doesn't even reckon our sin. That's the way that we do it. Love does not store up an account of wrongs. So when you go back and say, what did this person do wrong? You should pull up the ledger sheet and it should be blank because you erased it. Because you erased it all. So that's a tough thing. This is a heavy lift in love and we're not there yet. So what I would say is you try to throw up too much weight off the bench at your first stab. So pick somebody easier. That guy right there. Maybe hopefully he's easier to love. Give it a shot. Nope. No, it's harder than that one. Okay. So give that a shot and see if that helps. Yes, sir.
Well, I also tried one. I have a daughter. My oldest daughter is, I haven't seen her in 25 years. For reasons that her siblings haven't seen her, her mother hasn't seen her. She's a mess. So I thought, well, I'm not getting any younger, so I'm going to reach out. This was a heavy lift.
Right.
Still, it's just a mess. She's still a drug addict. She's a psychopathic liar. She's a terrible mess. So I reached out to her, and we met. I hadn't seen her in 25 years. And it went like this. I said, okay, the only way this is going to work is if you don't discuss any of the past. Just start at zero, at ground zero. So maybe that's some way you have to look at if you have something difficult. You have to just, it's a blank sheet.
For the
you can't bring up the past.
For the dozenth time in the class, the atheist has swung and hit the home run. Right, that is exactly right.
That's, she's a Christian.
Well, I'm talking about you. Have you changed? Something changed in the last week?
She's a Pentecostal Christian.
Okay. If she does, listen to what she says, just in case. This is an excellent point, though. You have to do exact. It's that's another way of putting the exact right point, which is the past almost doesn't exist when it comes to your regard for the person. Because if the person in the past has done a lot good for you, and only good, then you will likely remember that, and that will help you love them. But if the person that you're dealing with and you have, this is an interesting thing, tell me this isn't true, they have done 95 good things for you and 5 bad. When you start to regard them and you get upset or anything like that, what do you remember? Your mind automatically goes right back to the 5 wrong things they've done to you in your life, where 95 of the things could have been the greatest things that ever happened in your life. But you have to say to yourself, wait, I don't want to remember the 5. I remember this great thing that they did for me, and sometimes that helps you counterbalance it. Here's a real question for you. Why do we remember wrongs? Why, if wrongs are what's standing in our way, why are they so salient in our minds? Why do we remember them so strongly? And why are they the first things to which our minds go?
Makes it easier to avoid going back.
It does.
It justifies the resentment.
That's a great way of putting it. It basically justifies our own position of why we resent them in the first place. But let's say that we really in this place, really in this event, want to stop resenting them. We're making a conscious effort and we really, really want to stop doing it. Why does it still pop up, do you think? I think that's one reason. I think there are a couple more.
Do you affect it as one?
In what way?
Like, you personalize it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the effect that has on you is one that you both want to avoid, but sometimes seems unavoidable. So we're really trying to figure out how do you get past the unavoidable part. Any last stab? Anybody else want to give a shot?
I think we naturally make decisions anticipating what the consequences are going to be. And if we know what the consequences have been in the past, then that's, we just naturally anticipate that.
So I think it may be half and half these two things. And the scientist in us basically says this. For every 9 interactions I have with this person, 10 interactions I have with this person, one of them will go wrongly. So there's a 10% chance that the next time I interact with this person that I'm going to get something wrong. So as it turns out, you know, in my life, there's Lang, who half the time that I depend on him, he fails me. Steve, that 99% of the time he comes through. I want to stop being friends with Lang. I want to be closer friends with Steve. I'm not saying that's the calculus that we use to friendship. Sorry, just kidding. This was hypothetical. It's part of how we evaluate people. And if people think that you don't, if we live in a culture where egalitarianism, where being blind to racism and all those kinds of things are what we value. We don't want to do those things. But the downside is a lot of the science shows that we do keep a lot of those types of observations. People are, in fact, in the, this was an amazing thing. I still can't believe that this happened. In the Department of Defense now, they are trying to encourage everybody to embrace diversity a little bit more. And one of the books they gave us to read that's on the reading list of how to be more diverse is McDonald's success story called, I forget the name of the book, but it's like None of Us as Good as All of Us or something like that is the title of the book. And the diversity people who are there to kind of train you in diversity to answer your questions and all that kind of stuff, this is one of their prime books to which they go. Read this and it'll help you understand it. The major thesis of the book is entirely segregationist and racist. What the point was that they made was when McDonald's, we made our, we had businesses in Chicago during race riots back several decades ago. What we ended up having to do was it was in African American neighborhoods and Caucasian Americans owned the place. So we had them sell it to African Americans, but then those African Americans were viewed as not as, you know, on the side of the Caucasian Americans, so they had to sell it again to another set of African Americans. And the lady who wrote the book said this was the central thesis of the book. We feel more comfortable when a friendly face is across from us, both as a service provider and as a manager. And what she meant by that was, in black neighborhoods, we staff McDonald's with black workers and black managers. In Asian neighborhoods, we staff them with Asian workers and Asian managers. In Hispanic, 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 and white. They are pursuing a policy of segregation because they sell more hamburgers that way. And the DOD hasn't figured this out yet. I brought that up. I was less than popular at that place. We oftentimes want to evaluate people and say, how similar are they to what we are? That starts with the color of our skin, our height, our athleticism, our academic interests, everything. It's not just physical, it's the whole thing. The more you get to know somebody and the more dissimilar they are to you, sometimes the more alienated you feel from them. Now, is that the way that we want to be? That is a natural bent that we have for some reason, some good reasons and some bad reasons, and it's not a natural bent that we have in other reasons. But how similar are we to God? I mean, we have the image of God on us, but at least in my case, that's about where it stops. It doesn't seem to be much more similar between Almighty God and me. But even with as much differences there are between us, his regard for me is complete selfless love. And so can we do the same thing for somebody else? Obviously, yes. So when it comes to, we want to justify ourselves a little bit, and we also are evaluating whether or not that person's going to hurt us again. That both of them are contingent on one thing. That person has hurt us and we have experienced loss. That person has hurt us and we experienced loss. That's why we end up not liking people. They do something to us that we feel causes us loss. Now let me give you a strange example. What if you knew, I'll give you two examples. You put your wallet down here on the desk. You're talking to somebody else and I walk by and I steal $100 out of your wallet. And I leave. And eventually you find out that happened.
Not my wallet.
Not your wallet, right. Let's say you had $100 in your wallet, or $20 in your wallet, and I steal the $20 out of your wallet. You will experience a few things about me. One, disappointment. Why am I in a guy's class who's a petty thief? Two, lack of trust. Three, that kind of scientific evaluation of, well, this guy is not dependable anymore. He lacks integrity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you will feel upset at me. You may hold that against me kind of in the long run for a little while. Now let me sharpen it a little bit. Let's say that somebody had given you a gift, a scholarship fund. They literally put a check on your desk and then they walked off and you knew you'd never see them again for $100,000 to put your kids through college. And then I stole that check and you can't get it back. Now how upset are you going to be with me? The greater the loss, the greater the level of upset. Now let's take a third scenario. You've just found out via whatever your smartphone is or whatever that Ed McMahon is no longer alive, is he? Whoever the publisher's clearinghouse guy is for this week is knocking on your door and your wife or husband or whoever else is at your home says, hey, we just won $100 million. And then you find out that I stole $20 from you. How much do you care? You're like, keep it. I got no problem. You found out I stole $100,000 from you. You might be like, well, that wasn't very nice of that guy, but that's okay. I can send every kid I'll ever have to college, to any college I want, and probably buy the dorm in the meantime. When the loss that we have compared to the riches that we have the loss is so little compared to the riches, we brush it off. It's nothing. You are heirs of an eternal kingdom of God. You will have riches of which you cannot imagine. You will have joys that you cannot imagine. Anything that happens to you in this life is so negligible that for me to steal a penny out of your pocket is absolutely not even a comparison to how little any wrong that can be done in this life. This is why the martyrs of old who've gone through these horrific tortures can do so with a smile on their lips, because they know even that damage is no loss for them. In fact, it is gain. Paul says, what about loss and gain? Anybody remember? Say again. Yeah, to die. Dying is gain for him. It is moving. It is to die for Paul is to walk out of this building back to home to collect the check from Ed McMahon for $100 million. That's what death is to somebody who believes. So when you are worried about somebody, when you're dealing with hopefully a lighter lift, but eventually when you get to the heavier lift of somebody who has done you a little bit of wrong, that kind of wrong is something you can completely just wash over. Yep, sorry, no big deal. We're a little bit concerned about our own reputation. We want that person to think well of us, so we want to make excuses for ourselves. But when we eventually get to heaven, all they're going to see is perfected people with the image of Christ on them. Your reputation will never be that good. So don't bother building your own reputation. Let Christ be your reputation, and then you don't have to worry about it. Now, that sounds fancy and right-ish, at least in a Sunday school environment. What does it mean to let Christ be a representation? Well, it means to not care about anything other than what he cares about. she, the person with whom you're trying to love, eventually, when she comes to know who you are and she sees the depth of the love that you have for her, will look back on her own disappointment at that time, or her own, I was going to see what you would do, and be ashamed of it. Because she'll see the depth of the love you really had, and that this forgetfulness is not an indicator of how much you love her. It was an indicator of, I was busy at the time and other things took the place in my mind. So these are the kinds of things to remember when you are trying to love somebody is, if you truly, in my opinion, the greatest aid that you have to love in being a Christian is your ability, you ought to have the ability to forgive anything. Anything. But this is why I want to start with the light lift. It's easier to forgive somebody taking $20 out of your wallet than it is somebody to forgive somebody for taking $100,000 out of your account. So let's turn to the $20 people, thieves, and forgive them a little bit. And maybe we're the $20 thieves to other people too. By the way, if you're the $20 thief to somebody, if your brother has something against you, what is the Lord's command to you? Do you remember? If you remember your brother has something against you, what did Jesus say? Yes, it was. He was talking in the context of even there you are. You have gone. You're offering your sacrifice at the temple. Now that's not like going to church. Offering your sacrifice at the temple was a big deal. For some it was like a yearly thing. For some maybe more frequently. But they would leave where they were. They would bring their sacrifices or their money and buy the sacrifices there, which was the money changer thing that Jesus got mad at. And they would, this was a huge deal. This was your time for interacting with God. It was a worship. It was a forgiveness experience. It was all that kind of stuff. It was like Easter on steroids. That's what it was like. And there you are. And Jesus says, if you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your sacrifice at the altar and go and be reconciled to your brother. And then when you are reconciled to your brother, come back. What he says is this. God doesn't need your sacrifice, but they do need your reconciliation. So he's not saying forget God, but remember what God says is to serve others and love them. So this is part of that cycle that Christ seems to be teaching about. So in the case that you know you have offended a brother, and this, let's pick, again, your easy lift, somebody that's easy for you to love, ought to be, is easiest for you to love, whoever they are. If you know that you have done something wrong to them, one of the easiest things you can do this week or whenever else is go up and apologize to them for that. In the same way that you hold things in your mind about people even from grade school or high school that you haven't even seen then, or people from college or people from work or whatever that may not even know what's going on in your head, it's possible that your significant other or your friend at work or your school or whoever that you're trying to help has that same thing in their mind against you. And what's that doing to them? It's preventing them from loving you. If that's preventing them from loving you, and loving people is the best gift you can have, then isn't helping them get over that problem and love you one of the best gifts you can give them? Isn't love the greatest thing you can give them? So remove the obstacles to their love and let them experience love. So if you want to know, this is kind of the easy thing to do on the easy lift. If you have offended somebody on your easy lift this week, your task should be go back to them and just simply say this. Hey, remember when I X? I want you to know how sorry I am for that. And don't be a hypocrite about it. Obviously, if you don't feel sorry, then don't say it. But if you are sorry about it, go back and tell them you're sorry. And there are two things when you apologize. One is basically saying it. And what do you do after that? The story of Zacchaeus. Anybody remember the story of Zacchaeus? Who was Zacchaeus? Tax collector. What was the problem with the tax collectors? I'm in Afghanistan. We're close to the border in Pakistan, and we start interacting with this guy who's a border guard, I guess, border guard. They've got this little shack. He's got like one AK and 30 rounds of ammo, maybe, in that. So if anybody comes across the border, the only thing, he's not even going to be a speed bump. He's probably going to hand him the rifle and just be like, yep, go ahead, fellas, cobbles that direction. We got a border guard there, and his job was, not only is he a border guard, he's also the immigrations guy and tax guy. So if you're coming from Pakistan into Afghanistan, we weren't training these guys, we were Marines, we're working with some other local type of guys, but we interacted with this guy, and we got to talking with him, and I'm like, so he's way, way away from Kabul, and the road to where he is hundreds of kilometers of dirt, So I'm curious about how their government works and how it's set up. And we say to him, how much does the government pay you a year? And he says, some response back to the interpreter. I'm like, yeah, you didn't understand the question. Ask him again, how much does the government, what's his government salary? And the guy's like, the government doesn't pay me anything. Like, you're doing this out of the goodness of your own heart? I'm scratching my head. I'm like, so how do you collect tariffs? He's like, I look at the truck. I think I basically say, after the end of 10 minutes of conversing, because I didn't get it initially, how do you know what to charge him? The answer's back, whatever I think they'll pay. How much of that do you send back to the government? He's like, what are you talking about? Every dime that guy took off the truck just lined his pocket. That was it. That was it. That's how customs and immigration goes in the border areas of Afghanistan. And we say, well, that's ridiculous, isn't it? You try doing the math on what it costs us to keep a border guard in position and how much we charge in tariffs. And sometimes it might look very, very similar to that at some point. So that and the people who are back in the segregationist McDonald's book. So if Zacchaeus were to be viewed in our culture today, it's the guy is basically like a pimp combined with the worst type of CEO in the world. He's scum of the earth, because what he's doing is taking from the Jewish people, lining his pockets, and then, unlike the Afghan guy, he's giving the rest of it to Rome. So he is taking money from his people, giving it to the conqueror, and he's lining his pockets with the rest of it. The lining the pockets part was illegal. You were not supposed to do that. Rome did pay these guys, apparently, and so they had a salary, but they always did very, very well. And Zacchaeus said, after Jesus sees him in the tree, says, come on down. Because what he says is, here's all these people. And we can imagine around there are village elders, important people, good, righteous people. And Jesus looks past all these people who are close to him at this little dude in the tree, who's the biggest dirtbag in the village. And he says, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm honoring your house today by dining there. This is like if Ravi Zacharias or Billy Graham or somebody came here. You know, Mike Minter's like, I wonder if he'll come to my house for dinner. We're like, I wonder if he'll come to my house for dinner. He walks up to who's somebody who's begging on the street, and he says, I want to go with you to the shelter for dinner. That's the kind of idea behind it. So Jesus honors this guy's household, and because of this honor, he repents. And then what does he say he's going to do? If I have stolen from anyone, I will pay them back. I believe it was four times. It's what there are different, it's either double or four times, different laws in Deuteronomy that if you take something from somebody, you owe them back some factor more, sometimes quadruple. So he basically says, I'm coming in accordance in the law and I will make restitution. If you have done wrong to somebody, go overboard in doing right to them to make up for it. So if you want to know how sorry you are, doesn't it bother you when somebody says, listen, I'm sorry, but, I think I said this last time, that's not an apology. An apology is you are going to take something out of your treasure and put it into their treasure. Why is it okay to take money out of your treasury and put it in other people's treasury? Point one, it's not our money to begin with. We're stewards of God's money. What else? We still provide for ourselves out of that treasury a little bit, so God provides that for us so that we can provide for ourselves, our food, kids, clothing, all that kind of stuff. What else, though? So why now we're afraid? Well, I've turned the spigot on. I've let this money off to somebody else. Now what's the fear? Well, I'm not going to have enough for me. That doesn't make any sense if this is your treasury right here, and a guy with a treasury this big has a direct pipeline to yours. You spigot off one drop of treasure, and you're worried about it, and here's this pipeline leading to something that if they opened up the valves on this one, would blow your storage unit apart. This is the picture of what stands behind your treasure. Is God, and I'm not talking, it doesn't have to be financial. Sometimes it is financial. Recently, within, say, the last couple years, I had a brother in need. He and a sister had some difficulty with their cousins, etc. And by his generosity to, actually it wasn't a cousin, yes, it was a couple of cousins who lived in Eastern Europe. Their generosity to the Eastern Europe people turned out to be something that ended up impacting their family. And so we got in a conversation. God said, give this person some money. I gave him that money, and I thought, well, you know what? This isn't mine. It's God's. I'll give it to them. And that means it's up to God to either give it back or not as he wishes. 3 weeks later, 3 weeks later, God had poured out of the most ridiculous things you've ever wanted to see, poured exactly that amount right back into my bank account. Because this is the system that he owns. So now if that person came back to me 2 years later and said, hey, here's this money to give back to you, I'm like, you're too late. God repaid it 3 weeks after you had it. That's how it works in the kingdom. Now, why did God do that for me? I think so that I could give the example to you, at least. But it's not always money. In fact, a lot of times it's something better than that. Would you not give somebody $1,000, $10,000 of your own money if at the end of that they walked away with the reputation, the belief about you, that you believe in your faith so much that when it comes time in heaven and you're on trial, that they stand up as a witness for the defense and say, let me tell you what this person did. They believed in me so much they gave me $1,000 out of their pocket solely because of obedience to you. They said, because Jesus said, if I see somebody in need, I'm supposed to do that. That is worth the money, I will tell you, I think, in my opinion. And think of the good feelings that you have. And I think I said this a few times ago, not everybody was here. When you compare the feeling of having done good for somebody, and you think about it now, 2, 3, 5, 10 years in the future, isn't that joy still there for you? Aren't you still happy and proud of the good that you've done them? Now, remember the thing that was immediately great was the iPhone 4S came out for the first time, and you got it. And you're like, this is amazing. Look at this tiny little phone. Now you're like, what is this? Paperweight. The joy from the first time that you opened your iPhone 4S, does that remain today, or is it laughable? So the only true joy that lasts in a long time is doing good. So take the treasure you have that you otherwise can buy iPhones with and buy joy that does not fail. And I'm not talking about in the next life. I'm talking about in this life, right? In this life. So when you're thinking, how do I motivate myself to love somebody who's difficult to love or easy to love, remember that the joy that you will have in the future is directly proportional to how much time that you do this. Now let me do some quick math for you here, math-ish looking stuff. Each one of these units right here, here's a unit of, we'll say, material. And I'm going to call it spiritual, but what we also mean by this is basically doing good. So we're going to do good stuff. Whenever you do something materially that feels good, you win a championship, you buy a car that you've wanted for a long time, you get a bonus at work, and you think of all the things you can do with the money. Isn't thinking about the things you can do with the money more fun than the things you always end up doing with the money anyway? And you do this. Now here's a clock over time. Okay, and these are graduated in maybe years. You do something material. This material, let's say that gave you a value of +3 in happiness right here. By the time that a year has passed, there may not be much residual happiness. It may only be a +1. And by the time 2 years has passed, you may not even remember this as happiness. This, to me, is the iPhone 4. Your residual joy on having first gotten an iPhone 4 is probably all gone right now. Anybody still happy about owning the iPhone 4? Giddy? Right? No? I use that as an example. I'm an iPhone guy because I can't figure out how to work an Android. So then here, in year two, you do something, and it gives you a +2. Well, this is now a +1 and a 0. And you can see that over time, you're basically carrying a balance. And this is a very simplistic idea. But at any given time, maybe your joy is at a +3, and you're 5 years down the road. Well, what about spiritual good? Here's where you did something good for somebody, and it was a +2 for you. And you think back on it a year later, and it is either a +2... or sometimes it's like a +2.1. Why? Because you looking back on it, realize not only was that a good thing for me to do, here's all the benefit that I gained from it, and it still is something that's happy and joyful for me. And then you do something in the next year that's a +3, and then it stays as a +3, and you still got this +2.1, and you see the pattern. The more good you do, the better, honestly, the better you feel about yourself. The better you feel about yourself, the better reserve you have to treat other people who would dime you out and say, I don't like this person. Yes, sir.
Going and trying to keep in line with this science thing that we're talking about, modal logic and something that is necessary. I think what you have described, at least what I'm getting out of this, is on the material aspect, anything that's material is on a diminishing scale of degradation.
Yep, the economic principle is
right. Everything.
Diminishing marginal returns, even of the same things that you're doing.
Everything yep. that is material. Everything is
right.
degrading.
Right.
However, on the spiritual side, that's infinity.
Right. By that, if what you mean is there is no limit to how much it can accumulate, then I think that is correct. There's no limit to it. So that is the point that I'm trying to make, is the longer you live and the more good you do, the better you're going to feel, the more joyful you will be, and the easier it is to be joyful to somebody else. Let me give you one other quick example of this, and we'll go to the next example. So I'm going to go back to my Marine days. I'm a Marine captain. I'm captaining around doing my Marine thing. And another Marine captain, of whom I think highly, who's also a Marine and has done a lot of Marine things, tells me, hey, man, I really think that you did this wrong. I think you kind of were a little bit of a dirtbag here. How much is that going to affect me? You know, when you were doing this military operation, you kind of messed this up. A lot. I'm going to take that very much to heart. I'm going to probably chew over it. I'll worry about it, all that kind of stuff. A long-haired protester who hates the military, I walk by him and he's like, you're a baby killer and a dirtbag. How much do I care what that guy has to say? My question might be to him, what service were you in? Well, I wasn't in the service. I'd never go in there. Have you done any humanitarian assistance for anybody? No, man. It's just live and love. I'm not trying to be mean to hippies here. I'm trying to paint a caricature. And this guy says, no, I haven't done any of that. Why do I care what he has to say? He is not a man of virtue, and I don't care what non-virtuous people think of my virtue. In the same way that you probably don't care what a prostitute thinks about your sexual purity. They don't sit in a position of superiority or even equivalence. They are someone who has not earned the right to think things of you. This is why being a rock star is a terrible thing. It's a horrible thing. Here you are, you're standing on stage, and there may be tens of thousands of people cheering for you and thinking that they love you, and they don't know you at all. The acclaim. Now, here you are. Has anybody seen the documentary It Might Get Loud? Okay, this is Jimmy Page, Jack White, and The Edge from U2 all sit down and talk about guitar stuff. It was kind of a neat little documentary. I was amused, but I'm not a musical guy, but it was very entertaining. In this documentary, if Jimmy Page and Jack White say something back and forth to each other, and Jimmy Page says to Jack White, yeah, I really, really liked this particular riff that you played. Jack White is going to be on a high for the rest of his life and will probably, when he's 80 years old in the retirement home, be like, well, Jimmy Page told me that this was the best riff he's ever heard. You know, it went from I really liked it to that's the best riff he ever heard and he wish he could write it. So that's what happens when we have somebody that we think is on parity with us. When a guy that can't even hold the guitar in the right directions tells Jack White he's a terrible guitarist, White's going to be like, you got no credit with me, man. I don't care what you think. This is why you don't have to worry about your reputation with other people. I'll say it again. You don't have to worry about your reputation with other people. The only people you should care about are the people whom you admire greatly. Isn't it the case that you don't care what I think of your financial planning? Because who am I? If you knew a guy, Dan as an example, does some financial advising stuff. He's told me a few stories about, namelessly about people who are very, very wealthy. If that very, very wealthy person tells Dan, Dan, I think that you should probably, this is a good investment strategy to follow. Dan's probably got his ear tuned in. Whereas if I'm $100,000 in debt and I'm like, I got a new investment, man, you ought to look into it for your clients. Dan's going to be like, very politely like, oh, I appreciate your, I'll have a look at that. I'll think about it for a while. And he's like, whatever that is, sell it a lot. Cause that guy thinks it's a good idea. You only care about people who have proven themselves in their area. Hopefully I've made the point. Why am I beating this point into the ground? That's not how we act. We act like the people at work that in our own minds, we're like, that guy's really not that good a person. He's got some serious shortcomings. Or that girl is really kind of mean. We still want their good. We want to be in their good graces. We want their acclaim and admiration. Why would you want the admiration of somebody who you know's judgment is seriously off? If they think you're a good person, or they think you're a great person, you should be a little bit worried. Unless the reason they think you're a great person sounds like this, and you'll hear this occasionally. You know, I don't really agree with that guy. I think he's a little bit of a bigot, but he really does seem to believe in this thing about loving other people, and he's really done great things for me. That's the kind of regard that you want from people who you don't trust their judgment. Note that there's only one set of behaviors that will garner that kind of regard, and it's acting in love towards them. So the only thing you care about that other person is, do they think that I'm putting out the effort to love you? I'll bet you, Mason, if we were to ask that girl in private about the things that you've done for her, her story would be more positive than the one that she tells you. This happens a lot. People say good things behind your back as well as bad things behind your back. So that point, I hope, is good enough, but let that be reasons for going out of your way to do good for people. Initially, let's talk about what we want to do this week. For people that you love, that you have done some wrong to, and it doesn't have to be serious wrong. It can be anything. It can be, I spoke to you too hastily. It can be, I didn't remember your birthday the way that I wanted it to, or that you wanted it to, anything like that. Let it be trivial, but go back and do something about it and watch that person be surprised. Nobody does this. Nobody does this. Nobody comes back and says, Al, you know, I remember we were having, I'll do one for Al right now. I remember we were having a discussion with Dennis and somebody else, and I can't remember exactly where, but out here, and you made a point, and I actually cut you off and made my own point. I apologize for that. I was not regarding you in the right way, and I feel badly about that. I probably should have let you talk, because at the end of the conversation, the point that you had was dead on, and we probably would have cut 10 minutes of talking out of it if I just listened to Al in the first place. All right, look at Al. He's smiling. And I could have made up that story for all you know. Al, he's a good man. This is the power of restitution. This is the power of apology. And I can do it for two reasons. One, the treasure chamber that stands above me and the God who will look at me. So after I do that, if I go back and apologize to somebody and other people are like, well, I didn't know he did that. That's terrible of him doing that. Or I didn't, and that other person's like, I don't like him anyway. There is the ultimate person will look at me, and at least on that case, and say this, well done, good and faithful servant. Well, it doesn't get any better than that. That's a great thing to hear. I hope I hear that someday. That's my life's goal. All right. What other, did anybody else have experiences this week they want to share or stuff they want to talk about? Too much jabbering on my part.
I had a positive experience. There's somebody that I've been tutoring in school periodically, and it's been a very rocky relationship. I mean, there's been a lot of positive, but there's been a lot of bad, and to the point where, you know, his emotions will get so strong that we just can't proceed together, that type of thing. And we're just talking about school stuff,
right?
I mean,
right.
It shouldn't be this emotional impact stuff.
Personally, yeah, right.
Yeah, and so we went back into a tutoring after a long break, and it started to break down along those emotional lines. And again, what I would just credit to is, you know, God's power and just intervening. He got past that. We worked, we got to the point of tears. The tears came. We talked through it. There was healing between the two of us as we got to what the issues really were behind the tears that had been there for so long.
Right.
That finally came out, and there was like a catharsis in our relationship as a result of that coming out.
Yep.
And then we went on for an unbelievable 2 hours of productivity, and our relationship was incredibly strengthened as a result.
And I will note, and you know, Carl's embarrassed by the fact that we're going to hold him up as an example on this one, but this doesn't happen until we make the first step, and sometimes the second and the third step. On an easy lift, it happens in a couple of steps. On the Olympic lift, it may be a marathon. But this is why we want this kind of experience. I mean, you hear the story. I hear the story, and I'm like, I want to do that. I like that. I want to do that. Hopefully that inspires you a little bit, too. But that's what the easy lift will do for you. And like Skyler said, enough of these easy lifts become cumulative enough that you gain enough strength and confidence that you can do the Olympic lift. So that's why we're working our way to the hard person by a series of doing it with easier people with whom we wish to interact. So listen to this, be encouraged by it, and do it. All right. Let me leave others for a second here. You know your task this week. Your task this week is pick the easiest person you do a lot of good things that are hard. You know, you're a natural at a lot of things. I was a natural at a couple of things. And the problem with being a natural at a couple of things is I'd walk right into something. In my case, flying came easy to me. I'd walk into flying, and I was like, I'm a pretty good pilot. Then I'd walk into something else and be like, yeah, I can do this really well, and I'd fail spectacularly. Because I happened to have the God-given ability to do some of this stuff right, but I didn't the other one. You're good at so many things. Don't let that confuse you with being good at love. Because love is a tricky thing that almost nobody does well. We haven't really been taught it terribly well. And it is truly a divine skill. So you want to know difficulty level. Difficulty level of love is, like, to max it, divinity. So that's how high the possibilities can go on it. That's how difficult it can be to do. But once you do more and more of it, it becomes easier and easier. All right, so your task here is pick the easiest person, find something you've done wrong to them, apologize for it, and make restitution. Do that this week and see how that turns out for you. And then if you can, add it to the things you've already been trying to do. But don't try too much too quickly. And if you don't want to get there yet, if you haven't tried this yet with somebody, if you haven't picked your significant other or whoever else, and you still haven't just even done the last week's assignment, which is the find out something about them that know them better so that you can love them better. If you haven't done that, do that this week and then do this the next week. All right, let's talk about the tougher part, God. Because it's asking how do we love God is the joking question that we ask, what do you get somebody who has everything? Right? If your secret Santa gift is the richest man on the planet, and you're like, what can I possibly buy that will be of benefit to them that they will like? And the answer is always what? If you ended up with the richest man or woman on the planet as someone to whom you had to give a gift, what do you think is the only thing you can do that would be meaningful to them?
Handmade.
Say again?
Handmade gifts.
Yeah, and why? But why? He can't buy a part of you, and he can't buy you. And the greater handmade gift isn't just a crocheted pillow that says you're a swell guy. What's a greater gift than that? Something that, let's say that guy's got a biography out. You read the biography, and he talks about in his youth, the thing that he loved most was he remembers most fondly about his birthday Christmas. Was that his mother got him a little, I actually know someone like this, it wasn't the richest man in the world, but there was a little Lifesavers box of candy that came in a book format. Now, they don't do this much anymore, but they are still around. But she got that and a little, basically like tiny artificial kitten of a certain type. And those stayed with her the rest of her life. My brother, this was my mom, actually, in this case, my brother went back and replicated that. And of course, she's crying tears at the, you know, we give her something really nice, and he gives her this stuff that total price less than $10, and she's crying with joy, because when you know somebody well, this was why I told you to find out know something about those people. When you know somebody well, that connection is very, very meaningful to them, and so that's what you should seek to do. Now, how do we know God well? Like the rich man. The only access you may have to him right now that you feel like you have to him that is back and forth, or at least forth in your direction, is his biography. So you've got his book. And you know, you can, if you by reading some of it, by particular portions of it, you can start to know what's important to God, and you can know stuff about his character as well. And who has had this experience? I have this one all the time. Reading the Gospels in particularly, Jesus' words and Jesus' actions. And I'll say a couple, at least three things come out occasionally. I'll read something and be like, that can't be what he meant. You know, what I think he just said can't be what he meant. I say that sometimes. Other times I'm like, I think I see his point, but man, it seems like it's not taking care of X, like it left something out. And sometimes I just shake my head and be like, man, that's hard for me to understand. The more, if that's how you feel, when you see those things, that's the difference between you and God. That's him being a certain way and you not knowing him. In my case, me not knowing him. And so if you want to know something, where to look? Where do I look to know something about God that I don't know? Start with the Gospels. Read until you come to a point where you're like, that doesn't seem right to me. Or I don't understand what he's getting at here. Or that can't be right. You've just identified the target area. For this is something God is that you don't get yet. That's a goal. There's a place for you to put your crosshairs to say, this is where I'm going to shoot to find out something about God that I don't know. And it may start out as simple as this. Lord, I read the story about the, pick one in there, about Zacchaeus. We'll stick Zacchaeus. I really don't understand why you treated him this way. Or yeah, I see that you treated Zacchaeus well, but what about that really good guy who actually was a righteous man, who was there, a leader of the synagogue or whatever, that you passed over? How should that guy feel? So I'm not, I'm making stuff up here. Those are probably not the kind of cases that I've looked at. But there's one where you'll say, all right, I'm going to study this story more, and now what do we do? If we want to know about God, what has he promised us? This is not a promise that you have from your significant other or your Olympic lift. What has he promised you once you do this? So he wants you to do three things, and let's talk about what those are. And so this will be your assignment for this week when it comes to loving God. Now, these are metaphorical terms. So let's talk about what they mean. Ask seems relatively obvious. Ask is prayer. Ask is prayer, I think. If you're going to pray, do two things. Do two things. I'm in Afghanistan, again, marining around, and one of our fellow Marines says something to something about, I forget exactly the term he said, but something about, God's going to be on our side in this one right here. And hopefully he'll give the enemy over to our hands, kind of thing. And this other guy, who was a completely debauched Marine, looked over and said, I don't know if that I count on that being the case. Those guys pray five times a day. How often do you pray? And you see the guys just went blank. There was no real good retort to that one. So, I mean, you can bring up all you want about the object of their faith and all this other kind of stuff or whatever mitigation you want in there. But the bottom line was this. The guys that we were fighting, some of them took their religion much, much more seriously than the guy that was claiming God was going to be on his side. So when you ask, if you are praying without any kind of discipline, and when I say discipline, I mean, let's just talk the most basic thing about prayer, discipline-wise. I want God to know I'm serious about it. If I want you to know I'm serious about something, is it which of these two methods of interaction makes you feel better about it? If I say, hey, let's pretend I'm talking to this gentleman back here. I forgot your name, sir.
Justin.
Let's say I'm talking to Justin and I'm like, hey, man, I'd really be interested if you'd let me know when's a good time we could hang out. All right? That's one way of doing it. Another one is, hey, man, it was really good to meet you. I would love to schedule some time with you this week. You got any time this week that we could hang out? Just looking at a person in the face and acting like you're serious conveys meaning. When I pray, laying with my head on the pillow, I'm like, Lord, thank you for this, and I'm really sorry for that. That is the God equivalent of being like, hey, man, it was really nice to meet you. We should hang out sometime. Just standing up for 30 seconds in your house. Pick a direction to face. It doesn't matter. And say, Lord, this time's for you. And like Jesus said, when you pray, don't make it long. Fancy words aren't going to do you any good. You're not going to be heard because of your many words. God already knows what you need before you ask it. And just say this way, Lord, I need your help with this. Help me out, please. And I'm really sorry about this. And here's what I'm going to do about it. Or use the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is like this long. Great model. He provided it for a reason. And it wasn't so we could turn it into Latin and recite it without knowing. So we have to little dig at my Catholic brethren on that one. But the Protestants did the same thing, of course, 200 years later. So when you ask, do this. If it starts with one time a day this week, let it start with one time a day. If you want to ratchet up to Daniel level, you do it three times a day. Three times a day, 60 seconds, you think you can pull that off? Stop where you are or go somewhere semi-special. And by semi-special, I mean just not in the direct path in which you're walking. Take two steps off your path. Talk to God for 60 seconds. Make your request known to him and walk. And the request you want to know in this case is, Lord, I don't understand this. Will you teach me? Seek. What does seek look like? Do you think?
Research.
This is the, you are interested in buying a, whatever the car is that you're about to buy. What do you do? Gentlemen, this is to you. Ball's in your court here. You're thinking about buying another car. What do you start doing? First step.
ConsumerReport.org.
ConsumerReport.org. You start to find out what the maintenance record is. You find out what other people say about it, what the reviews say, etc. What's next? Yeah, test drive if you want. You get out of your schedule, you go to the dealership, you get yourself behind the wheel sometimes. You go on autotrader.com to find out what the value of it, how much am I going to have to pay for this kind of thing. You often do research, and sometimes tell me this isn't wrong. You're doing it on your smartphone because it won't leave your mind. You're just thinking about it, and you're not scheduling time to do it. It's suggesting itself to you, and you're doing it. Why? Because you really, really want it. You really, really want it. We don't really, really want God. This is a problem. Now, let me make you feel better about why you don't want God. Why do you want the car? Why do you want the car?
It's going to be fun to have a new car.
It's going to be fun to have a new car. There's a reward there. But there's a reward with the God stuff, too. So that seems to be balanced. What else?
Advertising.
This world tells you and does not stop telling you how cool you'll be if you have this car, how worthwhile the car is. And this is the thing that drives me nuts about Porsche owners. I talk to them all. There's multiple ones at DOD, who are mostly contractors. That should tell you something. That have these Porsches. They've been saving up their whole life for the Porsche. And you know what they tell me all the time? I'm like, so where do you guys take it to the track? He's like, no, I don't take it to the track. Where do you drive? Like 267. Like what time? You know, 8 o'clock in the morning. You're driving 50 miles an hour. He goes, yeah, it's really frustrating. So you bought a car that can go 160 miles an hour, and you've never driven it faster than 70.
For no longer period of time, maybe 6 or 7 seconds.
Right, when somebody breaks in front of you. So the thing I never got about that is when you get something that you want, when you seek it, you've looked for it, we have been told something. If you own a Porsche, it will make you happy. It's a fast car. But you have no opportunity to use a fast car unless you're a race driver or unless you want to lose your license in the span of a week. So we seek things because this culture is spending billions of dollars convincing you what to do. So don't feel badly that you want that. What you should say to yourself is, well, that's interesting. How about I stop wanting Porsches and figure out something interesting? Now, once you do that, what was the secret to getting you to want the Porsche? Marketing. What's the secret? And what is marketing? What is marketing? Does anybody know anything about marketing? What's the one or two things you have to do to somebody to market to them effectively? Know your audience. Then what? Make them feel like they need something. And so to do so, you appeal to something that they want. This is why, for reasons that still don't, you know, I remember back in the 80s and the Super Bowl kind of stuff, when I want to sell beer, what do I put on TV?
Women.
Because the connection's obvious, right? Women love guys that drink beer. Wait a second. Let's back up. All right. Let me start again. I want beer. I want to know if I should drink beer or not. This woman, here's a pretty woman. What's the connection there? I still, to this day, still don't see it.
Mother's love.
Right? I mean, so, right. Maybe so. Maybe if your mother loved beer that much, then maybe so. How about Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola, it's Christmas time. They want to teach you to like Coca-Cola. What are they going to show you?
Polar bears.
Because polar bears and Coca-Cola fit perfectly together. They appeal to something that you like, and they link it together. It's that simple. Appeal to something you like and link it together. And they suggest to you that if you do X, then you will get Y. Number of guys, percentage of the population, do you think by drinking Bud Light instead of Heineken have married a supermodel? Nope. Zero-ish? 1%? So, and of course, the guy that married a supermodel went on 60 Minutes and said, after winning 3 Super Bowls, I feel like there should be something more. If I was his wife, I'd have I'd take some exception to that. Be like, there's me. Do you have a problem with that? It was Tom Brady on 60 Minutes. So put yourself in a place where you market to yourself. Where do you go where people are going to convince you that doing these things is good? And the bottom line is this. You have to immerse. We are like tofu. We have the taste of what we soak in. And the more you soak in the world, the more you taste like the world, the more you think like the world. Dan's heard this before because he knows who brings this up. This isn't my example. The more you soak in the things of God, the more you will taste like the things of God, the more you will be like the things of God. And so I'm not saying just hang out in church all the time, but if you're not going to a place, you go when you press the remote button or the search bar. You go somewhere. It's a website. You go and you learn. Go and learn good things and not things that aren't going to reward you. And what you'll find is that which is difficult will become easy. As easy as walking down the aisle of the grocery store and watching the thing that's been advertised pass by you and you reaching over and having to stop yourself from reaching over to pick it off the shelf. That's how easy it'll be. That's what this will become like. All right, so seeking means you do the research and you put yourself in. What's knocking mean? What's the difference between seeking and knocking? There's a reason you use both words, I think. Okay, yes, maybe that's part of it too. I still want to put all that under seek in my mind. I think that's what it is. I think it's and without the meditation, I think you don't take the action. So it means you've been listening really good to what I said earlier, which is if you don't meditate on the action, you won't take it in time. But the bottom line is the connection here is action. This is saying you want it. This is looking for it. And this is grabbing it when it's there. All right? This means that when you have it, you do it. You do something about it. So when we're talking about looking for stuff for God, now I've told you where to search. Find a place that you don't know that much about God and ask and then seek answers to it. And knock means that when somebody, let's say that you write an email to somebody that you think is a wise man or woman, a Christian, and you say, I've been having trouble with this passage in Matthew. I don't understand what God, there's some character quality of God here I don't get. And he or she says, yeah, you know, can't really explain it to you in an email, but like we could get together sometime. Or he doesn't even say that. He's like, yeah, you know, it's a complicated thing. You write back, you're like, do you think you understand? And he goes, yeah, I think so. What's knocking look like in this scenario? Do you have any time this week that we could have breakfast, lunch, dinner, get together? I'm going to take time out of my schedule and stop doing things in the world, and I'm going to take an hour of the however many hours are in a week, and I'm going to dedicate it to knowing God a little bit better. When you do this, God will reveal himself to you, period, in end of sentence. I guarantee you he will. He has done it for me. I don't do this very well. I don't do it frequently, but when I do it, it happens, period. And I told you the planting a story. There's no better example than that one right there. I asked a question about God. It took me a couple years to get there at least. And then God's like, not a problem. I'll put you in front of the world's greatest living Christian philosopher. And he can answer it for you if my answer for you isn't sufficient in fuzzy slippers. God does not wear fuzzy slippers in my concept. I'm planning it does. Do this week. Do this. Give this a shot. And see if God doesn't, if the reward of knowing him better doesn't inspire you to do much. I'll finish on this. One of our major questions, and the one that's going to keep coming up, is how do we desire to do the right thing more? The answer is do the right thing, and it will build your desire. Smile first, be happy later, a little bit. It's not that simple. But the more you do it, you can see how it adds up to you. And then I explained the neuroscience of why this works last time. So I remember this is a series on science, how science makes you a better Christian. But we're into the scientific principles here. This is the outworking of those principles. There's nothing here that is magic. This is stuff that science can tell you clearly. We've outlined some of that kind of stuff, and I would take that scientific effort. And note that even a guy who will tell you, I'm not a Christian, I don't believe it, I think it's nonsense, here's all the reasons it arose in the first place. Look at what he, as a scientist, he's a chemist and a patent, he knows to do this. Dennis said, I'm going to sit down with someone with whom I got a lot of history, and I'm going to say the past doesn't exist. That's found in Scripture. But he didn't find it from Scripture, he knew it from science. And what I'll tell you is that science and Scripture will marry perfectly. So in your scriptural pursuits, do it scientifically. And in your scientific pursuits, pursue it scripturally. And I think you'll find that it'll work out well for you. Any final questions here? Because it looks like we're about out of time. We're exactly out of time. I wish. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. We'll see you again hopefully next week. Thanks for your time.